Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Although I moved away from Chico over 2 years ago, reading your column has continued to be a weekly ritual, dear Anthony. You've been great company to me along the path of my life in the last decade. Another reader commented, "I consider you a friend even though we have never met." These readers are referring to essayist Anthony Peyton Porter, who for 9 years wrote a column for the Chico News and Review. Mr. Porter himself writes, "Anybody who reads my work is bound to be disturbed eventually." And sure enough, a reader of one of his columns called him a total jerk. In fact, Mr. Porter has finally ended up in prison, but teaching creative writing at High Desert State Prison in Susanville. His column, From the Edge, appeared on the back page of the Chico News and Review, and he now has collected these essays in a book. Can he say that? 100 From the Edge, with images by Janice Porter. Anthony Peyton Porter, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, I mentioned this prison, that you go to prison because you're a teacher.
I am.
And you're teaching writing there in Susanville.
Yes. Every week, depending on the snow.
Oh. Well, before we go any further, I probably should say, since some of your readers are have strong feelings about what you have to say, that your opinions that you express are yours and not necessarily those of North State Public Radio.
Amen.
Because it must be nice, though, to know that people are reading your column and reacting to it.
Yes. I mean, I write for an audience. And, it's not like I do a diary or anything. It's always for somebody to read.
And in fact, when I'm reading your essays, Anthony, I feel like you're talking to me.
I am.
It's a very personal thing. It's an experience. And I am so caught up in what you're saying that I feel like you're talking directly to me.
Good.
So I enjoy that conversational style you have. So maybe that's why people say, "Well, can he say that?"
Right, to me personally. Yeah. Yes,
in
I
fact,
can.
I love the title of your book.
Well, it came from when I was doing radio commentary in the Twin Cities, and I got it through Janice.
Your wife.
And she said that my wife. She said that that's what was a common reaction to people that she would say, "Can he really say that? Is that legal?"
Because a lot of people don't have the nerve to say what you say.
Apparently.
Or write what you write.
Well, a lot of people don't think what I think.
Well, let's read an example of your writing. There's an essay in your book called Name Calling. And you say you were called insensitive, arrogant, heartless, uncaring. My goodness, that's quite a list, Anthony.
Right, and more.
Well, let's hear the essay, Name Calling.
Name calling. I was called insensitive, arrogant, heartless, and uncaring, all in the same unsigned letter. Then I got an email wherein another intrepid reader concluded that because I use the word retarded, I lack social intelligence, which is probably true. I've said before that only children miss out on early socialization that siblings suffer through. And their development in that regard may be somewhat retarded. Some of us never managed to take up the slack. She also called me another word, on which accusation opinion so far varies somewhat. And then she said that she actually chose her occupation because it was easier than putting up with jerks like you. I'm offended because you think you deserve the right to throw that word around. Close quote. I'm sure there are myriad jobs of work that for the average Jane would be less taxing than putting up with me. I took a long time finding compassion and affection for myself, and I'm not offended when someone doesn't like me. I feel for her. So my reader was offended by the story she made up about how she thinks I think. I deserve the right to throw that word around. She apparently accepts no responsibility for the thoughts in her own personal head or the way she feels when she thinks them. Instead, she blames it all on me. who has never even seen her head. I'd have expected her eventually to notice that bad feelings accompany certain of her thoughts and not others. But if these bad thoughts came about only because of my condition anyway, I guess the bad feelings are inevitably also out of her control. I was tempted to allude to the possibility of thinking deliberately, but I didn't think her likely to take advice from a jerk or anybody else like me. So I whipped out my legendary restraint and tried thinking kind thoughts about her. Good practice. My reader also showed remarkable restraint. She wrote, "I'm willing to bet you'd be the first to pipe up if a white female like myself complained of being worked like a cotton-picking nigger. So what gives you the right to use retarded?" I don't see the connection between those two clauses, but I am retarded, so I won't sweat it. Still, the heart of this jerk swells with admiration for my reader's nice manners and sense of decency, because a lesser person might have come right out and called me a cotton-picking nigger. My gentle reader, though, resisted the temptation to resort to an archaic cliché and merely mentioned it in passing, though I suggest hyphenating cotton-picking when used as an adjective. Minnesota schools will no longer use works by Harper Lee and Mark Twain, because To Kill a Mockingbird and The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, two of the best American novels ever, include nigger and niggers as nouns. Very wussy.
This is Anthony Peyton Porter reading from his collection of essays, Can He Say That? 100 From the Edge. And the subtitle, From the Edge, you might remind people where that comes from.
Well, originally, it was assigned to me by my producer and the host on the radio show where I used to do commentary in the Twin Cities, KFAI Community Radio. And it was also, and then it later became the name of my column in the Chico News and Review. And the edge is where I seem to be.
Yes, you're edgy.
I am edgy. seldom deliberately, but I'm just the way I think.
Well, you've mentioned the Twin Cities a couple of times, and you have an essay where you give a little bit of your background, and this is called Mr. Black Man. And would you read from that essay? It's on page 129 in your book, Anthony.
Mr. Black Man. I wore my Mr. Black Man costume to church one Sunday. This is from 2009, by the way. I've got this beautiful embroidered dashiki that a friend gave me some years ago. I think she thought I wasn't black enough. It wouldn't be the first time. Some years ago, when I took my recent wife and brand new son to Chicago, I didn't take them around everywhere I went. There were people there I'd known forever, whom I wanted to say hello to, who were not going to be happy that I'd married a white woman and was sporting a blue-eyed baby boy. One woman I'd partied with in high school and who had been a friend when I needed one asked me why I had married a white woman. Couldn't I have found a black woman? She thought I owed her an answer. I thought so too, and I said that race wasn't important to me, which was comfortably simple-minded and true. I recognize that perceptions and expectations around race affect human relationships, including mine. I just don't give race any more attention than I have to, and that's usually no attention at all. A job interviewer once asked me which cultural group I was most comfortable with. I said if I had to rank them, I'd have to say I was most comfortable around black people, since that's who I knew best. Wrong answer. No job. I was expected to be equally at ease with all groups, which seemed like a silly requirement and still does. That's where tolerance comes in. I went to high school and college with white people, and I work with them on most jobs, but other than the occasional drink after work, I socialized mainly with black people and dated only black women. Then I moved to Minnesota, and I haven't had a black woman in now 30 years. I was in Minnesota 2 years before I met another black person. I would see one on the street now and then, and sometimes I'd run across black people at outdoor events, but the things I did and in which I was interested didn't cause me to see many black people. They still don't. In Chico, there are way fewer black people even than in Lilywhite, Minnesota, for Pete's sake, so I felt conspicuous in my dashiki at church. I should also say that I had on my black leather kepi with the stripes and liberation colors, red, black, and green. I was not only Mr. Black Man, I was the black man, the Negro. I've been the voice of the Negro at libraries, book signings, and on nonprofit boards. For 9 years, I was the Negro in the Chico News and Review, way in the back.
This is essayist Anthony Peyton Porter. He is reading from his collection of essays, Can He Say That? 100 From the Edge. And your book, then on the cover of your book, it says Images by Janice Porter. And I was particularly interested in one in your book. This is fairly early in your book, where it shows a room with a guy with his knee behind his shoulder and his ankle behind his head, and then a woman who's leaning back into a back bend with her head on the floor behind her. And I was particularly interested in these. This is on page 44 in your book, Anthony, because I have done those particular positions in my course of practicing yoga. These are yoga poses. I can give you the Sanskrit name if anybody was interested, because I happen to like words. But so apparently yoga was a part of her life.
Yes. She more or less introduced me to yoga. And a combination of yoga and a really terrific chiropractor pulled me through a serious back problem I had in the mid-90s. But that's really when I was introduced to yoga, to try to stand up straight.
Well, it might surprise people that you do have a practice, meditation. You often mention the benefits of meditation. You recommend it to all of us.
Anybody, everybody, yeah. It's
and
good for you.
To me, there's not really a line between meditation and the practice of physical poses.
You're right. There's a lot of overlap. Yeah. But, you know, this is all just a soup. And there, you never know what will affect something else.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. We're going to take a short break. And after that, I'll be back with my guest, Anthony Peyton Porter, author of Can He Say That? I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, columnist Anthony Peyton Porter, who has collected his essays in a book, Can He Say That? Well, you have graciously asked me to read some of your essays, Anthony, and I feel very comfortable reading them because you and I, in some ways, couldn't be more different. I mean, our skin color, our gender, but we're the same demographic age-wise, I think. I think we were born in the same year. I won't say what year, but that would give you away. But I feel so comfortable reading what you wrote because I think, yeah, That's true. So, if you don't mind, I'm going to read from an essay that you call Pride.
Oh, yes.
And I would like to read this one because I think often women have more trouble accepting a compliment graciously than men do. That if somebody is telling me I have on a nice dress, I thought, oh, this old thing. Instead, I've tried to turn that around and accept graciously a compliment. But you made me think about this in a different way. Here's what you had to say about pride. Nice shirt, she said. I replied, it is, isn't it? She said, I've never heard you say that before. Most people, when I give them a compliment, say, thank you. You just agree with me. What's up with that? You're polite. You know how to act in public. How come you don't say thank you? I explained. I don't say thank you in response to most compliments. It's not that I'm not glad that somebody wants to say something good about me. I like that part. It's that most people seem to pay me compliments about things that don't have much to do with me. And for me at least, thank you doesn't make sense. The other day at the office, when a coworker said, nice shirt, and I replied, it is, isn't it? I wasn't rubbing her nose in the niceness of my shirt. I was agreeing with her sensibilities and aesthetic judgment. I think it is a nice shirt. I think that too. That's why I bought it and wear it as often as I do. But that's all I did, buy it and wear it. I didn't design it. I didn't make the cloth. I didn't construct it. And since I didn't have anything to do with its creation, saying thank you seems like taking credit under false pretenses. All I did was buy it. Any moron can buy something. Why should I thank her? I suppose I could say thank you on behalf of the people who were involved in the creation of my shirt, but I've already thanked them mutely many times for the excellence of their efforts. That seems like enough. On more or less the same hand, I think pride should be earned, not only out of some sense of Newtonian action and reaction, but because that's when it feels best to me. I see people who are proud and arrogant about where they were born, as though being born in that particular place could be achieved only through grueling effort, great intellectual prowess, and steely resolve, when actually they had nothing to do with it, and it was probably years before anybody even told them where they were. Some people are proud of the way they look, as though chiseled features or sensuous lips or whatever it is they've got going for them, was just part of the set they wisely assembled from all the possibilities. It seems to me that a lot of misery could be avoided if people just quit being proud of their homeland and their culture and their religion and all those other things that are largely thrust upon us and that are far easier to accept or to cheer than to examine, let alone resist. I'm reading from an essay by Anthony Peyton Porter, and the title of this essay is Pride. He wrote this in 2008. Do you have anything, Anthony, you'd like to add to that at this date?
No, I'm proud of even fewer things than I used to be. Although I'm proud of this book, frankly, because it was hard work.
Over a period of quite a few years, in fact, this collection of essays.
Right, and it took over a year just to put it together, although I didn't have to write anything, you know. So,
yeah. Well, this essay on pride, again, it caused me to think, well, yeah, what is a proper response? Because you say that it's more than just this person says, that's nice, and then you reply, thank you. And you say pride should be earned, not out of some sense of action and reaction, because that's when it feels best to me.
Mm-hmm. For instance, I'm not proud of anything that I didn't have something to do with. I'm proud of my sons because I know in some way I helped that along. But I'm not proud of, it's like being proud of being 5'9". It's not an achievement.
You just hang around, and before you know it, there you are, 5'9".
Right. And then shorter as time goes on, yeah.
That happens. Well, in some ways, you remind me, one of my favorite writers, Malcolm Gladwell takes things that people think intuitively, well, this is the way things are,
right,
and nobody questions it. And then he takes something and says, maybe our intuition is misleading us. Maybe this is not true as we assume. And I felt that way in reading your book, that assumptions that we just take for granted, we grow up with, we collectively think this is the way things are, and that it can't be changed. And
everybody,
you come along. And
sometimes it can.
Yeah, but it might not occur to us to change it. And then people like you point out, let's take a look at this.
Right. Is that really what we thought it was? You know, it might not be. It might be much more.
And, for example, you have a view on schools that must shock people, Anthony. How do you feel about our school system?
I think it's a significant contributor to the economy, like the prison industrial complex or the military and a lot of things that give people jobs, but I don't know that they really are all that helpful. It's just the imposition of a particular cultural view and set of values on as many people as possible. Because if you don't go, you better have a really good reason. You better be going somewhere.
Because the powers that be determine, here's what you should, we need more workers who
That's
have
right.
these skills. And you say, well, what about the child? Shouldn't we consider what is of interest to the child?
All right, well, that doesn't matter. Yeah. We find a way to channel that into some commercially useful activity, usually.
Well, there was a woman who was a scientist who wanted to interest children in science. She had an exhibit at the Gateway Science Museum. And she says, what are kids interested in? Not what we impose on them, where they may not be interested. And kids are interested in gooey, slimy stuff. So she wrote her books on those kind of topics. You kind of edge that way yourself in some of your essays. You get into things that people say, ooh.
I know, the gooey, slimy stuff. Yeah, I like that appellation.
But you're not afraid to write about that.
No. Just words. They're always an approximation of something. So, don't relax.
Speaking of words, I happen to have loved words since I was a little kid. I remember in the first grade wishing, I wish they'd give me homework. I want some homework. I couldn't even write yet, but I wanted homework because I loved words. And one of your essays you entitled Nitpicking.
Yes.
And some of us, particularly if we've been a teacher, are rather nitpicky. Do you find that when you're teaching your current students now, do you find you're nitpicky? Or do they think you're nitpicky?
No, they don't, because I deliberately just avoid nitpicking. sometimes I'll give them something that, they think is a detail. But, I teach.
I might remind people that your students are in prison.
My students are all convicted criminals in Susanville. And many of them are there for life. For them, the proper use of a semicolon is not critical. They can do without that. And, if I can just get them to write something, just find a way to express themselves more clearly and in a way that satisfies them primarily, because generally they're the only ones who will see what they write other than, their family that they write to.
Well, I mentioned you currently now are a teacher at this prison, but the list of jobs that you have had over your lifetime, Anthony, is quite impressive. Some of them we would expect from you, like a proofreader, a copy editor, a book editor, author, of course, magazine editor, radio producer, and you currently teach writing, but you also delivered newspapers. You not only wrote for newspapers, you delivered them.
I did. Yeah, my career has been spotty at best. And until, say, the mid-80s, I had no real direction. I had no real career or anything. I just did what guys tended to do in where I grew up, where you you worked for whoever hired you. Hardly anybody had a career, or, you know, or something that they were aiming for. You just found a job. And that's generally what I did until about the mid-'80s, early 80s. And I realized that maybe I won't live forever. Maybe I've really got.
We don't think that when we're 20.
This was by the time I was in my 30s, I realized that if I were going to do something, I should. And so I started with writing in a journal because a diary sounded sissy. but it gave me some practice. And speed this up, a friend of mine saw me doing a crossword puzzle once and said, I bet you'd be a good editor. And at that point, I didn't know what an editor was. So I got a couple of books, which is what I do when I want to, you know, that's my go-to. And I taught myself. And I took, in those days, I don't know how it is now, pretty much anybody who published anything, newspapers or books or magazines or even posters, would give an entry employee a proofreading test, or maybe copy editing, depending on what it was. And I took those tests all over the Twin Cities, all over Minneapolis and St. Paul, until somebody hired me. yeah.
So pretty much, if you've got a book on something, you can teach yourself.
Yes.
Well, you've been a theater critic.
Yes.
And were you, would think that you would be honest about it, and maybe some of the actors or the director weren't always pleased with what you had to say?
No, they weren't. But I did that for, I don't know, a couple of years in the late 90s. I was reviewing a lot of plays, essentially, for the St. Paul Pioneer Press and the Minneapolis Star Tribune. I stopped. Mostly because I didn't like the form. There's a particular format for that newspapers generally follow, and there are certain aspects of the performance, the production that you're supposed to talk about and using certain terms. And I just didn't like it. It was too restrictive, and I wanted to do a more impressionistic take. I haven't done that lately.
Well, besides theater critic, you've been a book reviewer.
Yeah.
And one thing that might surprise people, you've been a house cleaner. I'll bet you did a great job.
I was very good, yeah.
Because you have attention to detail.
Yes. And I became a house cleaner because I edited a How to Be a Cleaner book done by a guy who was a cleaner in Minneapolis. And in doing the book, I went with him on a couple of jobs just to see what it was like. And I said, I could do this. This was after I had made one of my several horrendous career decisions that just didn't even blow up. It just kind of sank. and I had a family to feed, so that looked reasonable. So I did that for some years, actually.
So you read a book about house cleaning, and off you go on and become a house cleaner.
Right. Yeah, but it paid the mortgage.
Well, you've also been a radio commentator and voiceover. So if people are listening, they say, boy, that guy has a nice voice for radio. He should be on radio.
Yeah, well, he has been here and there. When we first moved to Chico in 2003, I had nothing whatsoever to do, and I didn't know anybody. The first time I came to Chico was when we moved here. And that fall, I took a voiceover class with a woman named Susan Hayward.
The Susan Hayward?
No. in Sacramento. And it was several weeks, and I learned a lot, and I got a couple of jobs. I did a spot for Villaraigosa during his first campaign for mayor of L.A. But it, you know, it never went very well. That takes a lot of marketing. I'm not a good marketer.
Well, you have been a math tutor. We think of words, but you must be good with numbers, too.
Well, I was good enough. This was actually a guy, one of my oldest friends, who was in college and was having difficulty, you know, and he knew I would do it for nothing. So I did.
Well, you have so many more occupations that might surprise people. Urban lumberjack. I didn't even know there was such a thing as an urban lumberjack.
That's what I call it. It's a tree trimmer. I did that for a couple of years in the late 70s.
Well, that would keep you physically fit, I would think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You don't, I mean, there's not really a lot of activity. I was a rope man. So I was the guy who held the rope so that the limb wouldn't take out the garage.
We'll continue our conversation after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is Anthony Peyton Porter, who for 9 years wrote a column called From the Edge that appeared on the back page of the Chico News and Review. I mentioned that you have one essay called Nitpicking.
Yes.
And you start out by saying, language can drive you crazy if you let it. I know I'm a little peculiar when it comes to words, and I try to be broad-minded and open when it comes to bad diction and sloppy usage. Sometimes I succeed, sometimes not. For example, look at, quote, butts with a critical eye. I tend to look at language generally with a critical eye, and I'm especially interested in but and other words that set up contrasts, like although and however. My objection is that the contrasts are usually misleading and often false. The word but is especially insidious. One of the most common misuses of but is in phrases like poor but happy, which assumes that one wouldn't ordinarily expect a poor person to be happy, that somehow poverty and happiness aren't usually found together. And so the use of but is justified to highlight the contradiction inherent in any poor person's happiness. Of course, but isn't justified in this example, and perhaps not in most of the contexts in which it is found. Blonde but smart. Simple but beautiful. Compassionate but conservative. Dumb but educated. But is nearly always a poor choice when one is trying simply to impart information without a slant. Try this. Many students take that test, and some do well. Then, many students take that test, but few do well. As a description of what happens with the test, both statements may be true, depending on how we define few. Let's assume that they are true. The first sentence states more or less plainly what seems to happen. The second sentence puts a negative spin on the same phenomena and serves perhaps to discourage prospective test takers about their prospects of excelling, solely as a result of the writer's or speaker's subtle assumption about that group of test takers. As a parent, I'm curious about the ways our opinions and premises are affected by suggestions, and so I'm on a constant but watch. I tend to commas, too. Serial commas in particular. Serial commas are the one before the final conjunction of the series. The Twin Cities, comma, Berkeley, comma, and Sacramento. In this instance, the serial comma is all that stands between the reader, namely you, and the erroneous notion that Berkeley and Sacramento are the Twin Cities, referred to by the first item in the series. The use of commas, serial commas, is fading fast in mass media, promoted primarily by the Associated Press style book and libel manual, which should be ignored by anybody with a fondness for clarity. Popularity is not commensurate with quality. Thus, we got VHS tapes, commercial television, Microsoft, and Facebook. This essay is by Anthony Peyton Porter. It's called Nitpicking. And you point out the fact that we use the word but when so many times it's uncalled for.
Almost always, actually. Sometimes just a comma would do. And is usually a much better choice than but. And I still, and sometimes it jumps out of my mouth and I have to fix it.
Well, I can just imagine paying a compliment to somebody. That dress looks nice on you, but... And whatever comes after that but...
is not going to help.
Is not going to help. And it would be so much nicer to put the word and in there, or as you say, a comma in there. And that would change the whole complexion of that essay. You have some essays that I liked your essays anyway, but there's one on Martin Luther King. And I hope you would like to read that, Anthony. This is an essay on Martin Luther King that you wrote in 2010. And this is on page 199 in your book.
I don't remember Martin Luther King, Jr., because I never met him. If you never met him, you don't remember him either. What I remember are monochromatic images, a few speeches, and some stuff I read. That's not a man. That the Federal Bureau of Investigation tapped King's telephones and secretly recorded conversations and planted agents in his organization and tried to drive him to despair with threats so he would commit suicide doesn't surprise me. If the FBI were even a middle-class white man, it would have been locked up long ago. One of the things the FBI found out was that King liked women a lot. Mostly Coretta, but definitely not just her. Some people seem to think his marital infidelity invalidates his achievements. Those people are stupid. King always wanted to be a preacher. He started college at 15, and when he got the call, he answered. He didn't dodge the hard parts. And he didn't just organize marches and demonstrations, he led them, like generals used to do back when they had to be brave. He wasn't afraid to die, unlike many spurious Christians, and after the Dream speech in 1963, the FBI said he was the most dangerous and effective Negro leader in the country. The FBI director referred to King as degenerate and disgusting. In correspondence, a draft of a letter sent to King calls him an, quote, evil, abnormal beast, close quote, and suggests that there's only one thing he can do to avoid public exposure of his fraudulent self. Soon King came to realize the relationship of poverty to war and imperialism. And in 1967 in New York, he said, quote, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is my own government, which wasn't common knowledge like it is now. The FBI says that it always gets its man. And in April 1968, after all black police and firefighters were transferred away from the 2nd Precinct Fire Station across the street from the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, and King was relocated to a room there that was more open to view, and 4 tactical police units in the area were reassigned away just that morning, King was shot dead on the balcony. The official version didn't make much sense, and that's not unusual. For example, John F. Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald, Fred Hampton, and Mark Clark, the Waco siege, Wounded Knee, and 9/11, for starters. James Earl Ray did time for the killing, but even the King family didn't think much of that. In 1999, a civil jury in Memphis decided that Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated as part of a conspiracy, quote, including agencies of his own government, close quote. That quote is from what Jim Douglas wrote in the spring 2000 issue of Probe magazine. I have never met him either.
This is Anthony Peyton Porter reading from his collection of essays, Can He Say That? 100 From the Edge. You close that essay with, I've never met him either. And it happens that I have met Jim Douglas, and I'm a fan of his writing. He is a thorough researcher, and he started out writing about these people who were assassinated, and his publisher said, we can't publish a book with that many pages. No, because he had, well, for one thing, this conspiracies that he wrote. Right. And so he had to divide the books that he was going to write into 3 separate books. And his one on Kennedy, for example, was 400 pages of text and 100 pages of notes. So I find his writing very interesting.
That's impressive. Yeah, he's good.
It is impressive. Now, you have an essay on Jesus that you wrote, and this is on page 180 in your book. And anything you want to say before you start this essay on Jesus?
No, I think it speaks for itself.
Okay, let's hear that one.
Jesus. I grew up in the Episcopal Church. And on the ceiling was a ginormous fresco of God as an old man with lots of flowing white hair. I'm going to start that over. Jesus. I grew up in the Episcopal Church. And on the ceiling was a ginormous fresco of a God as an old man with lots of flowing white hair. A white man, needless to say, but I will anyway. Spaced around the nave were paintings of the Stations of the Cross, featuring a matching Jesus with flowing brown hair under his crown of thorns. In all the stories I heard in Sunday school and elsewhere, Jesus invariably came off as a simpering, masochistic wuss. I thought I knew what turning the other cheek would do for me. He got points for throwing the money changers out of the temple, but money changers may have been chicken back then, and in situations like that, if you weren't there, you don't know. Why a guy who could heal the sick, feed the multitudes, and walk on water wouldn't save himself from an agonizing death eluded me. So he was a crazy wuss. I suppose knowing what he knew made him seem to act crazy anyway, especially since he wouldn't quit talking about it. I considered the possibility that he was mythical, that he was simply a literary character cobbled together from various hoary stories. I read what I could find, and I still think it's anybody's guess. The Jesus story is similar to those of several other mythological figures and may well have been appropriated. I don't care. What I care about are his messages. Namely, love one another, including your enemies, and share what you have, and live and let live, and treat people well and kindly, and anyone can find the spirit and kingdom within. Anybody. Jesus was a socialist. Those few guidelines sum up Jesus for me. And I say that knowing full well that nobody wrote down anything about him until he was dead and long gone. Not to mention that all of the people who did write about him had their own expectations, gleaned from whatever they had heard from other people, who probably had never even seen Jesus of Nazareth, much less talked to him. And they wrote in Aramaic, which way later was translated into Greek, as in, it's Greek to me, and then into Latin, for Pete's sake, and eventually into flowery and now archaic English, and hip-deep in agendas and egos the whole time. After all that, I still feel confident in saying that Jesus was a heck of a man, ideally or historically, take your pick. And one of the best things about him is that he wasn't a Christian. Anybody who supports killing and says he gets Jesus is a liar. And you know he and Mary Magdalene had a thing.
This is Anthony Peyton Porter reading from his collection of essays. This one was entitled Jesus. And you have an essay in your book. This one you just read was 2012. You have an earlier essay where the last sentence, two sentences in your essay. So I've settled on being a Jesus imitator. Very tricky, but God's illiterate, so at least it's simple. See you in the afterlife. Now, that makes us chuckle. You wrote that in 2007. Before you and we knew what death was going to be coming your way, your beloved wife, Janice.
Yes.
And I would like you to read an essay you wrote that you entitled Reality. This you wrote in 2012. It's on page 247 in your book. And, Anthony, it came a time when I could not bear to read your essays because they touched me so deeply. Because I became a widow myself, and the things that you wrote were so true to my own experience that I felt like you were talking to me when you were writing about your wife, Janice. So would you read us Reality?
Yes. Reality. I've been having more and more difficulty writing this column. I have only a few ideas. I feel like I've worn them out, and ideas don't interest me much anymore. I can't concentrate. I could say stuff about the presidential campaigns and all of that, or medical cannabis, or nuclear power, or local goofs, or even meditation, or love, or tolerance, or consciousness, or forgiveness. Except when I try to formulate a thought, let alone a sentence, I remember how sick Janice is. Sick doesn't begin to describe her experience. At the cancer clinic in Arizona, I was with her most of the time. During our second stay, I'd sometimes find something to do, often involving Thai food or a thrift store, while she was getting some therapy or other. But mostly I was with her. I just wanted to be there, and still do. Although there's precious little I can do to help her and nothing I can do to make a difference. I can't fix her. I've never felt more helpless than I do now. I can't do squat. Well, not exactly. I can drive her around and carry stuff and run errands and wash dishes and make her alkalizing juice and flush her IV and tell her that I love her. So I do. Big deal. What she needs is a miracle. I'm working on one. I've heard that serious illness can be a blessing. I know that blessings can have some of the best disguises, so I suppose that's possible. Janice's illness has brought us closer together, and that's a good thing. It has also made most quotidian bothers fade into the background. I even don't think nearly so much about what my sons want as I used to. They weren't asking me to think about them anyway, and letting them fend for themselves means I assign myself fewer tasks. Janice gets more of my limited energy, and they grow up faster. Nice. One cliche I've verified is that life-threatening illness clears up what's important and what isn't. That's one reason I don't pay much attention to politics anymore. I don't care who wins the presidential election, because there's not much difference between Obama and Romney anyway, and the clueless public schools have kept most of us ignorant enough to go along with whatever the big boys want for years to come. Politics is just a story. Reality is at home.
That's Anthony Peyton Porter reading his essay, Reality, that he wrote in 2012. There are other essays on that subject. For example, one called How's Janice? Friends ask you, how's Janice? How's she doing? Is she feeling better? And you came to say, well, she has good days, which was vague enough and still true. You have several essays on Janice, what she went through and what you went through after she died.
Right.
And I have to tell you, Anthony, it was hard reading these essays. It made me cry all over again from when you originally wrote them.
Yeah.
So
I quit reading them.
You did. Well, because I was going to be talking to you about them, I made my way through them, but again, not without crying. And as I said, your essays, we barely scratched the surface of what you express opinions on that people may say, oh, can he say that?
Can he say that?
Can he say that? So I'm glad that you have recorded this for a new generation of readers who might have missed your column From the Edge that appeared in the Chico News and Review.
Heaven forbid.
Again, the title of his book is Can He Say That? By Anthony Peyton Porter.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.